It's here and now, and it's a busy week at the Supreme Court. Today, the justices rejected a challenge to an assault-style weapons ban in the Chicago suburb of Highland Park. And tomorrow and Wednesday, the court will consider a couple of interesting issues, the principle of one person, one vote, and whether universities should be able to consider race as a factor in admissions. Emily Bazelon is a staff writer at the New York Times Magazine and a fellow at Yale Law School. She's with us from New Haven. Hi, Emily.
Hi, Jeremy.
So first of all, this case from the Chicago suburb of Highland Park, the court deciding to reject this challenge to an assault weapons ban there. Tell us about that.
This is a pretty complete assault weapons ban. Highland Park bans most long firearms and also some types of magazines. Most commonly owned semi-automatic weapons is the best way to think about this. And the court did reject this challenge, which means this assault weapons ban will stand, even though a few years ago the court ruled very strongly in favor of a Second Amendment right to bear arms. And so there is a strong dissent from this decision not to hear the case from Justice Clarence Thomas and Justice Scalia. And they are saying that this ban really flies in the face of the court's previous decision, and they are upset that the court has chosen to let it stand.
Does it tell you anything about where the court is right now on the issue of the Second Amendment?
I think it's interesting that the court is letting such a complete ban on semi-automatic weapons stand, and it suggests that the majority of the justices think there is a lot of room for cities and towns to regulate firearms despite the Second Amendment right to bear arms.
There are a couple of other cases that we're going to be hearing about this week, and I want to talk to you about them because they're very interesting, starting with this idea of one person, one vote. The court is going to be hearing two cases related to this, one out of Texas, one out of Arizona. Let's start with the whole idea here of one person, one vote. Remind us what that means.
Yeah, that's a great question. In the 60s, the court started worrying about the ways in which states draw districts for state elections, like state senate. And this also, of course, applies to congressional elections as well. Any election where you're dividing up the population. And previously, states had been allowed to have, you know, a small number of voters in an agricultural area and a lot of voters packed together in a city. And in the 1960s, the court said, no, you can't do it that way. All the votes have to count equally. In other words, you can't have one congressional representative representing a million people in a city and then someone out in the country representing many fewer people. And so that's the principle of one person, one vote, which has really determined how states can draw lines for districts for elections.
So what's the challenge in Texas?
Well, so what I said sounded really clear, but the problem is that the court ever since has used the term people, one person, and voters interchangeably. And so this challenge is brought by two voters in Texas who say that what one person, one vote really means and should be based on is not the total population of the state, but the number of voters or eligible voters. And usually these things would shake out the same way for districting purposes, right? But if you're in a state that has a lot of people who can't vote, in particular a lot of immigrants, like in Texas, then you could presumably live in a rural area with fewer immigrants, and you would end up with what these two challengers say is less access to your representative because you're in a place where there are more eligible voters per congressional representative where you live as opposed to some other part of the state.
So would a ruling in favor of these people who are bringing this challenge be good for Republicans or good for Democrats? Because I'm thinking if you're not going to count all the people who live in Texas as eligible voters in Texas, that state might have fewer electoral votes, right? Because there would be a smaller population being counted.
That could happen, but this challenge is only about state elections. So right now, we're just talking about the distribution of power within a state. And the answer to your question really depends on the demographics of a state. In theory, it could help either party. In practice, in Texas and other border states, given where people live, immigrants versus non-immigrants, this challenge, if it's successful, will empower rural areas at the expense of cities. And that is going to help Republicans win more elections and more seats and come at the disadvantage of Democrats.
And what about the case out of Arizona? What's the question there?
The case out of Arizona is a challenge to redistricting by a nonpartisan commission. This was supposed to take the politics out of redistricting. But Wesley Harris, the challenger here, says that this commission put too many voters into 16 Republican districts and too few into 11 Democratic districts. And so it's basically an accusation of skewing the way voters are distributed, a kind of gerrymandering.
And could either this case or the case out of Texas have an impact on the 2016 election?
It could, presumably, depending on how these cases are decided. I have to say that for a kind of boring technical reason, the Supreme Court essentially felt obligated to take this Texas case. It didn't reach out and grab this case. And so that suggests it may not really use this case to make any waves. And the common traditional understanding of one person, one vote may be more likely to stand.
Meanwhile, there is a case called Fisher versus the University of Texas that's going to be heard this week. This was brought by a white woman, Abigail Fisher, who did not get into the University of Texas at Austin. She sued, saying the school should not consider race as a factor in admissions. The court first heard this case in 2012. What happened then?
The case went back to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. They took another harder look at the University of Texas's justification for a version of affirmative action that the university is doing only affects about 20 to 25% of the slots. And the Court of Appeals accepted UT's justification for this program and allowed it to stand. So now Abigail Fisher is back in court again, asking the Supreme Court to intervene and strike down Texas's use of racial preferences at the university.
Is that very unusual for the court to hear the same case more than once?
It's happened before. It's not the normal course of events. Usually the Supreme Court kind of wipes its hands of cases once it's spoken. But this seems to be a particular set of concern for the justices. And it's possible that Anthony Kennedy, who is very much the swing vote on affirmative action, feels that the Fifth Circuit didn't really follow his instructions adequately the first time around.
We just heard from the court on affirmative action last year. What are they likely to do this time? Or do we have any sense of where they stand on that issue?
It's not a good sign for supporters of affirmative action that the court took this case back again. If it was happy with UT Austin's admissions policies, then it could have just left the whole thing alone. And so the question here is whether we're looking at a narrow ruling that only applies to UT, because the particular way that UT factors in racial preferences is very specific and not common to a lot of other schools. But it's also possible that Justice Kennedy will use this case as a vehicle to make a broader ruling that would have impact on universities nationwide and how they think about admissions.
And do you think that members of the court are paying attention to the movement across the country at college campuses on racial issues? Are they paying attention?
They're certainly aware of that, and I'm sure they're interested. I don't think it's going to directly affect their ruling, or certainly they won't let us know if that's happening. But I think it's important that there's this kind of backdrop right now in which students are demanding attention to issues of racial inequality. And there's also a backlash against them and concerns that they are suppressing free speech. Free speech is a very dear principle to Justice Kennedy. And so if he thinks that's what's going on campus, that is surely not going to help with the University of Texas.
Now, interestingly, Emily, there's a person who is behind both the Texas One Person, One Vote case and this Fisher case. His name is Edward Bloom. Who is he, and what's the deal?
He is a conservative activist who has gotten very good at using litigation to promote a conservative agenda. It's interesting because, you know, if you go back to the 60s and 70s, you think of liberal public interest groups as the force behind trying to change the law. So, example, environmentalists getting into court, civil rights activists, women's activists. There are lots of examples of liberal groups appealing to the courts for protection for their rights or for expanding the definition of their rights. More recently, however, conservatives have taken the same path, and Edward Bloom is one of the most skillful people who's really found a way to get his issues in front of the Supreme Court.
Interesting. Emily Bazelon, a staff writer at the New York Times Magazine and a fellow at Yale Law School, talking with us about some of the cases that the Supreme Court will be hearing this week. Emily, thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
And this term, the court is also taking up the issue of collective bargaining, the death penalty, and sentencing for defendants who were tried together. We'll be watching.